Okay, so we're going to start today's afternoon's informal discussion. So we are going to discuss about the interacting topological history. So the key problem here is that in the bulk and on the surface. So in the bulk, the question is how do we actually generate this topological invariance from a single particle to many body system. So by that, a way that a simple way we can use numerical people can compute these topological invariance for many body systems. So then Victor did some excellent work on how to extract these topological invariance using a Green's function and geek. So he will give a short introduction about that for 30 minutes.
Okay.
Then after that, Professor Imada will give some remarks. Then after the first part, and Ziyang also did some nice numerical simulations on some real model about interacting topological TI. So basically, it's a bilayer K-Malley-Hubbard model. So he has some very fresh result to show. Okay, so start.
Okay, so I would like to talk about using single particle Green's functions to characterize interacting electron systems. So I realized that this is a joint discussion session of two programs, and some people with condensed matter background know exactly what kind of problem we have when we study topological states of intermatter. But people from a different background, although they might actually be studying the same thing, but due to language differences and for other reasons, they might not know exactly which language I mean. So I thought that even though I only have half an hour, let me first spend a few minutes and define what topological states are, which maybe for most of the people here, it's going to be completely obvious, but maybe it'll still be helpful, so that will put things in perspective. And so in condensed matter physics, over the last few years, I think a definition emerged of something which we call topological states of matter. So topological states of matter are ground states of quantum interacting or non-interacting systems such that they have a gap in the spectrum. So the ground state is separated by a gap from all excited states. And so by definition, any gapful state, any ground state which is separated from excited state by a gap of some many-body system, is a topological state. And so that's a kind of a very general definition. And you could say that it's not a very useful definition because there's lots of gap states. But once you define it in this way, you can then realize that there are some topological states which are trivial and some topological states which are not trivial. And so trivial topological states are the ones which can be, as we say, adiabatically connected to other trivial topological states, so to say. So adiabatically connected means if I start slowly changing my Hamiltonian, the ground state will slowly be changing, and I'll be able to convert one ground state to another ground state without ever closing the gap. And so if I can convert one of these states, well, if I have a state which I'll call a reference trivial state, all other states which can be converted to it are also trivial. But I could also imagine classes of other states which can also be converted to each other, but cannot be converted to the trivial states without phase transitions. And those would be topologically non-trivial states. And so once you start working with topological and non-trivial states, this definition acquires more meaning. And so these days, when people talk about topological states, they like also to define certain subsets of topological states which are useful to work with. So we have topological states in general. So topological states, as I said, is a gapful states. And then among these topological states, we identify topological states of non-interacting electrons, or non-interacting fermions, generally. And so topological states of non-interacting fermions, in some sense, they're in a class of their own, not quite. I'll say it in a second in what sense maybe they're not. But this is what people usually call topological insulators. So each time they say topological insulators, they mean topological states of non-interacting fermions. So before 2005, people thought that the only topological states of non-interacting fermions are those which occur in integer quantum Hall effect. But these days we know that there's a lot more, thanks for the discovery of topological insulators. And now, more generally, people identify something called symmetry-protected topological states. So symmetry-protected topological states are gapful states which cannot be adiabatically converted into trivial gapful states as long as certain symmetries are preserved. So if you preserve a particular symmetry, then this state cannot be converted into the trivial state. But if you break that symmetry, you can convert that state into the trivial state. From that standpoint, you could say that symmetry-protected topological states, they kind of go beyond topological states. If you define topological states that there's no way you can convert that state into some other state without closing the gap, then, here you can convert the state or some of these states into other states if you are willing to break symmetry. So in some sense, that's like a separate separate set or separate definition of states. So a state could be non-topological under general definition, but still topological under the definition of symmetry-protected topological states. And so most of these guys are subsets of these guys. So most of the states of non-interacting fermions, which are topological, they're symmetry-protected topological states.
So in particle physics, when we talk about topological solutions, usually at some point there is a mapping of a sphere into a sphere or something like that. So when you have non-interacting fermions, where is the topology?
Well, so in this definition so far, there is no topology. But it turns out that to make sense of this, to work with this, you will have to come up with some topological arguments. And they come up later. So at first, there is no topology. You just say, well, there is the state, and you cannot convert into another state without closing the gap. So once you try to figure out under what conditions this can happen, you'll discover that there are some topological constraints on these states. And we'll see that.
Trivial mapping from one manifold to another, right? So is that what you
mean?
Well, this will come, right?
No, there's mapping, non-trivial mapping from the momentum space for target space. That's that's totally non-trivial.
Maybe the thing that is not states, non-interacting fermions, but they are not free. They live in a lattice, so they have a band structure.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Although in some cases they're free. Well, it depends. Electrons in the magnetic field, right? That's an example. But in some cases, they have a lattice structure. But they're still not interacting. OK, in any case, topological states of non-interacting fermions are a subset of symmetry-protected topological states. And then people also separately consider something called states with topological order or long-range entangled states. And these are more kind of genuine topological states. So these are states which do not require any symmetry to be topologically protected. So in some sense, they're more robust. So states here cannot be converted into any other states, no matter what you do. If you try to slowly change your Hamiltonian to convert the state into another state, well, at some point, you'll have to close the gap if you want to convert this. Here, however, you don't have to you don't have to close the gap as long as you're willing to break some symmetries. And most of these guys fall under this category. OK, so states with topological order are pretty intricate. I mean, they always involve some kind of interactions. They usually involve fractionalization. So the original example of such states, which was invented even before all this classification came up, is fractional Hall effect. So these are these kind of states. In fractional Hall effect, we have fractionalized particles. It's made of electrons, but if you look at excitations, they don't look like electrons. Here, the excitations still look kind of like particles you made the system out of. To some degree. And these are just non-interacting fermions. So probably can get much more than non-interacting fermions, again, with some caveats. These days, there's lots of people who work on understanding these topological states. And I would say that these guys are essentially understood. We know everything about them through the efforts of many people over the last 10 years. Now, these guys are understood somewhat less, but are also pretty well understood. People are still debating about the structure of these guys. I mean, they involve interactions. They're more complicated than these. Now, these guys, I would say, mostly maybe they're not understood. but there's a lot of progress, and lots of people are working on trying to elucidate the structure of states with topological order. I think in two dimensions, it's really fairly well understood nowadays, but in high number of dimensions, I think it's kind of all bets off, and people don't really know what's happening here. Now, what I would like to talk about is trying to use single particle Green's function to characterize different topological states and distinguish them from each other. So it turns out that while single particle Green's function is a convenient tool to look at various states, it does not encode the entire information you need to know about a particular state of matter. It only encodes some information, but not all. And so single particle Green's functions are probably not a good tool to completely classify all possible topological states. They're pretty good at classifying states of non-interacting fermions. I mean, you can use single particle Green's functions to classify these, but that's because these are non-interacting fermions. If you know single particle Green's function, you know everything about your system. Here, they're not as good. And so people used other criteria and other methods, much more sophisticated than single particle Green's functions, to understand why these guys are, well, how to classify these guys and how to classify these guys. Nevertheless, it appears, from what I'll tell you, that single particle Green's functions still have some information about the structure of these guys and maybe even these guys, although I would say that's probably the least understood. In this case, I think there's some understanding of what single particle Green's functions are doing. So, single particle Green's function is not a silver bullet. Most people working on understanding different topological states don't use them. Nevertheless, they're a convenient tool to look at numerically, and they could help in classifying different states or in figuring out which states we'll look at. And that's under what conditions I think I'd like to look at this problem of using single particle Green's functions. So it's a, kind of a, another tool out of many tools we have, could be useful for numerics, but it's definitely not the one tool which will tell us everything about different topological states from these two classes. But maybe they do say something about these classes. Okay, and so to make further progress, I need to talk first about non-interacting fermions and how they're classified, and then make a connection to how we can extend this into using single particle Green's functions to classify states, well, not maybe classify, but mischaracterize states of interacting fermions. And so non-interacting fermions, or topological insulators, as we like to call them, so they can be thought of as just non-interacting fermions hopping on some lattice, or maybe even moving in a continuous space. But usually it's more convenient to think of an underlying lattice on which these fermions hop. And so the Hamiltonian of such a system can generally be written as some matrix in the space of lattice sites and creation and annihilation operators. So that describes a fermion which hops from site J to site I with some hopping matrix element ij. Now, ij refers to lattice sites, but it may also refer to spin of this fermion, if the fermion has a spin. If there are several species of fermions, ij may also refer to the species of these fermions. So it's a kind of a combined index which refers to everything, all the degrees of freedom you have. Now, this particular Hamiltonian conserves a number of fermions. You can also add the U1 breaking terms, a squared and a dagger squared, to get a superconductor, and it's all actually doable within the formalism which I'm about to describe. But let me just, so that I wouldn't have to worry about this, let me just write this kind of Hamiltonian. And so, well, this describes non-interacting fermions, so we know what they do in the ground state. They just fill all the states up to some Fermi level. And the question is, suppose that state is gapful in the sense that they fill all the states up to some gap, and then the rest of the states, single particle states, are separated from the states we filled by a gap. Then our system is gapful, and the question is whether that system is topological in any sense. So it cannot be converted without closing the gap into other states. And so it's been argued, well, first by Taulis and collaborators more than 30 years ago, but more recently by people working with topological insulators, that these kind of systems are actually characterized by topological numbers, which you can assign to these matrices, hij. And these numbers uniquely tell you which topological phase you are in. And if you want to change that number, you have to perturb your matrix, hij, in such a way as to close the gap and then reopen it again and discover yourself in a completely different state with a different number, hij. So because there's a null interaction fermions, the entire information is contained within this matrix. So literally you're studying some kind of matrices, although these are matrices in space of sites in the lattice. And so there's a question of what kind of topological invariants you can write. So originally Tallis identified a particular topological invariant you can write if you're in two-dimensional space, which because he was interested in quantum Hall effect. And so we refer to that as a Chern number, which you can construct out of Hij. But more recently, after Cain and collaborators discovered a different type of topological invariant, many such invariants were identified. But they can all be reduced to invariants of two types, invariants which take either integer values or parity, the two type invariants. So either these or these, and they occur under different conditions. So these the two invariants were apparently missed by everybody except Paul Fenley mentioned them in 2001 in one paper, but still without much impact somehow. But in 2005, it was rediscovered by Cain and Melle, and then that gave rise to this whole new subject of topological insulators. But the invariants also, it turned out to be richer than what originally was thought. So Tallis identified a particular type of Z, but now we know there's at least, well, there's actually two types of Z invariants you can write. And now, how exactly write down these invariants depends on your taste. Let me write it in a way which will be useful for me, for my construction, and also for introducing interactions later. Let me define a Green's function, because I like Green's functions, as I omega minus h to the power of minus 1. So h is a matrix. I subtract with I omega. I invert the result. I call that the Green's function. Now, so this is the Green's function in the space of lattice sites, spin, flavor, and everything. Now, for the purpose of defining this topological invariant, let's imagine that we have some translational invariants, so we can define momenta. And if we do this, this Green's function becomes some matrix, but of a much smaller size. So people who work with lattices know that AB go over the basis of the lattice, which we have to work with. And this G depends on the frequency and on d-dimensional momenta on this lattice. So it's a much smaller matrix whose size gives us a number of bands we work with on a particular lattice. And now out of this GAB of omega and k, it's possible to construct topological numbers, which only change if the gap closes in the system. And so let me write down this number as it is usually written in two dimensions, although we can also write it in any number of dimensions. So in two dimensions, I'll write it like this. It's going to be some trace of the integral over d omega d2k divided by, I think it's 24 pi square, g minus 1, d alpha 1g, g minus 1, d alpha 2g, g minus 1, d alpha 3g, epsilon alpha 1, epsilon alpha 2, epsilon 3. And here I define derivative d0 as d d omega, d1 as d dkx, and d2 as d dky. So I hope it's clear what I mean by this. And summation over alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3 is implied. Each of these alphas is summed from 0 to 2.
So now you're working in the real time or imaginary time?
It's this G. So it's imaginary time.
Imaginary.
It's imaginary time Green's function. It's literally this thing. So if you have no interacting electrons, you don't need to think very much to know what G is. You just take this H, plug it in here, and that's your G. Okay. And now, so Tallis first identified this number. In fact, originally it was written in a different form, where it has a form of this Chern number, but it can also be written in this form, which was also done by Tallis in one of the later papers, by Tallis, of Wu and Nu, in 1985. And so you can argue, first of all, that this number only can only be integer, no matter what G is. Given some matrix G, which depends on G parameters, it's an integer. The reason is it characterizes homotopy classes of maps from omega k space to space of matrices. And you can also check by direct calculation that if you perturb G a little bit, this number does not change, variation of that, just mathematically, if little delta G is added to G is zero. So this number literally cannot change. The only way we can change this number if we start changing H in such a way that G becomes singular. And the only way for G to become singular, since H is Hermitian, so we need to have omega 0 and H have 0 eigenvalues. Then G is singular. So if we perturb our H in such a way that it acquires 0 eigenvalues, and then perturb it further that it stops having 0 eigenvalues, these numbers become singular, and then after we perturb it further, it can take some other value. No, I start with H whose M2 is 0, then I change this H. At some point, G is singular, then we have 0 eigenvalues of H. And then we change H further, and now M2 is some other number, let's say 1. And since H has 0 eigenvalues at some point, as we're deforming it, that means we went through a phase transition. So that's an argument why, in order to change this number, we have to go through a phase transition. And that's an argument why, at least within a one topological state, one topological phase, N2 should take the same value. Unless we close the gap, we cannot change N2. It's maybe not enough to argue that different N2 correspond to different phases.
How does the integrand behave for large omega?
Well, G goes as 1 over omega, and this thing is regular, in a sense, because G is proportional to identity matrix.
The derivatives goes to trouble.
Yeah, you have derivatives there, right? It becomes identity matrix multiplied by 1 over omega at large omega. And actually, any Higgins function, even for interacting systems, it's very large omega.
Yeah.
As long as the spectrum is bounded, I guess.
Right.
Well, it has to, well, okay, there are maybe some issues with that, but.
No, it has to be 1 over omega because fermions anti-commute.
Right, so you pick up the one. You pick up the anti-commutator.
Victor, I have a question. So what's the homotopy map here that we are talking about? So the original space is the 2 Lie-Brillouin zone times the time.
So it's like, right, it's the space from omega in two-dimensional k into a space of matrices.
Yeah, right.
So I think it's, that's how people usually write it. So the map of three-dimensional space into a space of matrices of size n by n with complex entries.
But that group in which GAB lives from presumably depends on some of the symmetries of the problem, no?
Well, here, this particular invariant does not depend on any symmetries. So that works for integer whole, for example. Right? So
but no the symmetry. Reason you have GL of NC is must be.
But that's the Green's function is an arbitrary complex matrix. And GLNC is an arbitrary complex matrix. So this doesn't require any symmetries. You can also look at symmetries.
So usually pi 3 is mapped from the 3 sphere. And
right.
You have the 3 torus, right? For the Green's one. So is
yes.
The reason you can pinch it into a sphere?
So that's true. First of all, there are examples of these Hamiltonians where K actually goes over the whole plane. Well, it's not when you have a Brillouin zone. So when you have a Brillouin zone, this is more like a torus, that's true. But there are examples, like in a P-wave superconductor, for example. That's a classic example. K runs over the entire plane. And now, there is an argument that even when K lies on the torus, at least you can have this classification, although you can have even more in that case. But usually people don't worry about this. They don't worry about the effects coming from K being on a line on the torus as opposed to a sphere. So let me put it just like this. And you can check, I mean, even if K lies on the torus, this is still an integer.
The fact that GLM is not compact does not bother?
What is not compact? GLM?
I mean,
somehow, no. No, that doesn't, that's not an issue.
Because usually it's, we have the SU2 and then the SUN containers.
Well, let me give you one example which will be useful. I'm just afraid that I'll run out of time. So this invariant is written in two-dimensional space, but actually similar invariants exist for any even-dimensional space when there's an odd even-dimensional space plus one time. In other words, in any odd-dimensional space time. So when you have any odd-dimensional space here, its map into the matrices gives you z. So I could replace this t by arbitrary d plus, n plus 1. As long as this 2n plus 1 is odd, this is z. If this number is even, then this group is trivial. It does not have this classification, but any odd dimensional space, this group is not trivial. And the corresponding topological invariant has exactly the same form, except you replace g minus 1 dg to this power. You raise it to the right power. So if you are in, if that number is 1, you just take 1 g minus 1 dg. If it's 3, like here, you take 3 g minus 1 dgs and so on. And so we could, just as an exercise, imagine that you have a matrix, G, some matrix, which is a function of some parameter K, let's say. I can write down this kind of expression. So that would be, and actually the normalization is 2 pi I in this case. So that's a one-dimensional analog of three-dimensional expression here. And if we think about what it is, let's imagine for a second it's just one by one matrix. So it's some complex number, Z, which is a function of K. So then this integral is dk over 2 pi I, dk logarithm Z of k. And so all it measures is whether that complex number winds around the origin or it doesn't wind around the origin. And you see, it doesn't matter if Z is small or large, compact, I mean, whether it runs away. I mean, as long it should not take zero value and infinity value. And we already took care of infinity by saying that H is never zero. And we take care of zero by saying this expression can never be zero because it's an inverse of something which is not infinity. At least when there's no interactions. That's one thing which changes when you have interactions. And so as long as this G is never singular, never zero or infinity, this is a quantized number. And so that's a one-dimensional analog of this three-dimensional number. Okay, so this number can be written in two dimensions, two spatial dimensions, four spatial dimensions, six spatial dimensions, and so on. And it actually matches with Chern number, second Chern number, and so on. Now, these kind of expressions were known, first to Taulis, but more recently people identified topological invariants which you could also write down in odd number of dimensions. So people identified actually invariants of the type Z and separately of the type Z2. Now Z2 are more complicated, I will not mention them. But invariants of the type Z, this is the one in two dimensions, but there is also the one in one dimension, three dimension, five dimension, which has a very similar form, but it's slightly different. I'm afraid I'll run out of time if I start writing this, although I wanted to give examples which are in one dimension, which would require those invariants. Let me not define them for now and just move on and then see. Maybe I can get I don't have to define them. All right, but so this invariant was invented a long time ago, and now one of the questions we could ask is, well, suppose I have interactions. Is it possible for me to still use this invariant? And so in the presence of interactions, we know we can still define a single particle Green's function, which without interaction reduces to this expression here. But with interaction, it's something which is defined in a more sophisticated way. So we define dij as ai of t, fj, aj, dagger of t prime, average with respect to the ground state of an interaction system. And then you have to do a Fourier transform with respect to t minus t prime. And I mean, if this is imaginary time, you automatically get this thing. Or you get the thing which becomes this if you switch off interactions. But in the presence of interactions, this is its own object, which no longer amounts to just I omega minus h to the power of minus 1. And so one of the proposals which was in literature, for example, put forward by Shuqian Zhang and collaborators, was that, we have this single particle Green's functions even when we have interactions, and maybe you can just stick it in here and compute this invariant, and it's still an invariant, some number, and using this number, we'll learn something about our system. In fact, more specifically, what they suggested to do, they said, well, usually when we work with topological insulators, we worry about this matrix. So we replace this matrix by G minus 1 computed at omega equal to 0. So this hoping, we imagine kind of a system associated with our interacting system, which is a non-interacting system, and whose hoping matrix is given by this guy, computed at 0 frequency, inverted with a minus sign. And then we start manipulating that system and try to understand how it behaves and make conclusions about how our interacting system behaves. Now, one of the problems with this approach is that in the case when there is no interactions, this invariant has a very specific meaning, which people are very well aware of. So, for example, this number here was originally calculated and identified with Hall conductance of such two-dimensional system. And so as you work with your non-interacting electrons, if they have a Hall conductance, you know, to change Hall conductance, you must go through a phase transition. You can give physical arguments why this is so. And so that clearly that number gives you different quantum Hall phases. In that case, it was quantum Hall phases for two-dimensional electrons, because to change that number, you change Hall conductance. But once you have interactions, if you stick in here single particle Green's function, what you will get probably will not be Hall conductance. Because, well, who knows what this is? There's no way to connect that to Hall conductance by calculation. In fact, conductance is not a property, a single particle property, when you have interactions. So without interaction, there are some subtle reasons why this actually gives you Hall conductance. But with interactions, this does not work. And so there's no physical interpretation of this number.
So can we start from, for example, Kugel formula, linear response equation, then we like apply some certain approximation on that. We probably just try to neglect the vertex correction.
Right. I think under some assumptions, such as neglecting vertex corrections, you can derive this formula even in the presence of interactions. But it's not clear if that works beyond some kind of perturbative regime close to non-interacting limit. So presumably that still gives you Hall conductance if you perturb slightly with weak interactions. But if your interactions drive a phase transition into a new fully interacting phase, then this number does not have to be Hall conductance. At least that's how I understand this. But so then my approach to try to give meaning to this number then was based on a different idea. And the idea was that so it was actually shown a long time ago by Volovic, and then more recently expanded upon by us, that if you take this number written here, it's also possible to define a different number, which is defined within the boundary of your system. And you can show that these two numbers, this topological invariant and the boundary number, they must be equal to each other at all times, even if your system is interacting. But the boundary expression tells us something about the structure of the boundary. So it tells us about what kind of physics, about single particle Green's functions at the boundary. And from the single particle Green's function at the boundary, maybe we'll learn something about the boundary. And then changing this number changes the property of the boundary. And many of these topological states, especially the ones in this and some of those in this class, they have interesting boundaries, which reflect the fact that these are topological states. And so this number tells us something about the boundary, even when there are interactions. And then the logic is, we'll be computing this number to extract information about the boundary. And let me tell you, so as I was afraid, I'm running out of time, but we'll see. I'll try not to spend too much time, and I hope you don't mind if I continue, because I do need to get to the punchline, especially having to do with zeros of this Green's function and their interpretation. So, what do I mean when I say we have information about the boundary? Well, in this example, suppose I have this Green's function computed in the bulk, and I evaluate this number here. Suppose completely separately, I consider the same system, but with a boundary. And the boundary is in some direction x, where the system terminates. And suppose that in this geometry with a boundary, I evaluate the Green's function as a function of I broke translational invariance in the direction perpendicular to the boundary, so it's a function of two positions along the boundary. It's no longer the function of the difference between position one and position two. It's a function of two independent positions, and also a function of momentum along the boundary, which I'll just call k, and frequency omega. Well, then, with this Green's function, it's possible for me to write down an expression which is very much parallel to what I had here, but erased. Here is the expression I can write down. It's an integral over some contour of g minus 1 d mu g, where the contour is a circle in the k omega domain, where k is a variable as 0, and k omega is variable as 0, k is variable as 1, and I'm doing this contour integral along a contour. And this inverse and multiplication is understood as multiplication in the matrix space, where xx prime play the role of matrix coordinates. So this is a matrix in the position space, and it's multiplied as a matrix, and a trace is computed as a matrix. So I could imagine this computing this quantity. And this quantity also is an integer, for reasons which I already brought up. It's a one-dimensional integral of this kind of form. And now it was shown by Volovic in the 80s that for any system for which this guy is not zero, this guy is also not zero, and they have to be equal to each other. And so that was generalized more recently by us in 2011 to hold for all kind of Z invariants, not just this guy, in arbitrary number of dimensions. It always works that this guy matches the analog of this guy in other number of dimensions. Okay, and now, so what does it tell me? So it tells me that if I have a system, even an interacting system, and I have its Green's function in the bulk, and I evaluate this number, I could equally well have this Green's function at the boundary and evaluate this number, and these two numbers must match. So if I do something to change this number, I should also change this number. So this number, in other words, tells me something about the structure of the boundary. And boundaries of topological states, they're more interesting in some cases, in many cases, let's put it this way, than the bulk. So the bulk is just gapful, but boundary typically has gapless excitations. And actually, it's very easy to see that in case when you have no interactions, specialize to the case of no interactions for a second. If there is no interaction and if your system is gapful, this is always zero. And the only way in the absence of interactions to make that thing non-zero is by having chiral gapless edge modes. And the way to see that is to rewrite this as a sum over eigenvalues of this G. Suppose G has eigenvalues, which I'll call lambda n, which are functions of k and omega. And so it's a sum over these eigenvalues of these contour integrals. And so literally what this quantity then does, it checks whether these lambdas n as complex numbers move around the origin as k and omega go around this contour. And now if I have some chiral edge modes, lambda n will look like I omega minus v k, if this is a mode which moves with velocity v along the boundary. And if you stick it in here, this will give you a contribution of 1, or maybe minus 1, depending how you choose the normalization. So that's because this mode is chiral. So if this mode is not chiral, this is k square, you plug it in here, it gives you a contribution of 0. Furthermore, some people get upset, they think, well, when it's linear in k, it's kind of clear. It's like a complex number which clearly winds around the origin, as k omega wind around the origin. But even if this is some non-analytic function, as long as it changes sign, you know, if this is epsilon of k, and if this guy has a property of epsilon of minus k is minus epsilon of k, or even doesn't even have to be that symmetric, as long as it's positive for positive k's and negative for negative k's, this gives you a contribution of 1. And so that then tells you that this number here must give you the total number of chiral edge modes. And if you change the sign of this mode, you change the chirality of these modes. Changing the chirality changes the sign of this. Now, this is something which people know about two-dimensional systems, well, without interactions, characterized by this invariant. That's one of the basic properties of topological insulators in two dimensions. But it's the way of understanding it via these expressions, via these topological invariants, gives us a tool to interpret this invariant even when there are interactions. Because we know that this should also be non-zero in the presence of interactions.
I'm just confused by one thing. This is a 1 plus 1e object, right?
Right.
While this was a 2 plus 1e guy.
Yes. Yes.
So when you mean this is equal to this?
Well, this has a value. Maybe I should call it n boundary.
So you view the 1 plus 1d as the boundary theory of the 2 plus 1e on the left?
Yes. So this was the same two-dimensional system, but with a boundary. And it had this Green's function, which reflected the fact that it had a boundary. And effectively it became, well, it only depends on two parameters, right? Because I got rid of xx prime by sticking them in the matrix indices of G. And so the claim is that this must be equal to that, whether you have interactions or not. To show that this is equal to that, you just manipulate Green's functions. You don't have to rely on any kind of underlying physics. Okay, but so then the plan is that we'll be evaluating this. It'll tell us something about this boundary object. And if that number changes, something changes with the boundary. But so you could ask me, doesn't mean that we can use this method to obtain full classifications of any interacting two-dimensional systems by just computing these invariants. Well, so it's not quite true for the following reason. So if you have interactions, G, as written here, can be actually zero. When I say G is zero, I mean it has zero eigenvalues. It could, in principle, have zero eigenvalues. And this number is badly defined if G is singular, but also if G has zero eigenvalues. In fact, that number is completely symmetric under G goes to G minus 1. So if I imagine a system which is fully gapped, but for which G, for some value of K and some value of omega, has zero eigenvalue, the system will not have well-defined N2. Furthermore, I could imagine having a system which I'll perturb or I'll change into, deform its Hamiltonian in such a way that G will be changing. And at some point, G will acquire zero eigenvalue. And as it acquires a zero eigenvalue, the number N2, as we go through that point in parameter space where it has zero eigenvalue, so N2 can change. But it will change without phase transition. So N2 is not a unique label which you can assign to different phases, because N2 can change, but we don't have a phase transition, in principle, at least. If G changes in such a way that it passes through point in the parameter space, it has zero eigenvalues. So having the zeros then can be interpreted as a bad sign that this number, for example, doesn't have to uniquely label different phases. Furthermore, it may so happen that this number is not zero, but there is no gapless excitations at the boundary. But this guy at the boundary is still not zero, not because G has a pole of this sort, but actually has a zero. Somehow G, eigenvalue of G, has a structure which looks like I omega minus vk to the first power. So what if there's some lambda n, which looks like this, as opposed to 1 over I omega minus vk. So without interactions, that's impossible, because this vanishes when omega and k both go to 0. And without interactions, we cannot have g, which vanishes. But with interactions, anything in principle can happen. So you can have this kind of eigenvalue. Then this will still contribute to this integral. And it will give you non-zero value, which will match the bulk value. But you have just, by arguing that this is the structure of the boundary, you basically untied these invariants from excitations which occur at the boundary. So in the presence of interactions, if this is not zero, that uniquely implies that there are chiral excitations at the boundary whose number is equal to the value of N2. But in the presence of interactions, you don't know this anymore.
Now, yeah, so question. So if the interaction, suppose you have a lambda n has this kind of I omega minus vk. So what will be the special function looks like? It's a single gap like special function or something?
Well, that's a different story actually. And in fact, I'm not even sure if this is a valid lambda n in two dimensions.
Right.
I know other types of lambdas which will have this kind of structure in other number of dimensions. In two dimensions, I'm not sure if that's allowed.
Uh-huh.
But it might be. In fact, you have an example where it could well be that that's what happens to lambda n.
But this is not as a necessary condition. I mean, it's just one of possibilities.
Yeah, yes, it's one of possibilities, right. Well, you have to have some kind of zero which has this winding property. So something which vanishes when omega and k goes to zero and which acquires a phase as you move along this contour. And that's the example of it. And I would imagine that in your example, so it's an example of a system whose N2 is not zero, which is interacting, but which doesn't seem to have any single particle gapless boundary excitations. It actually has collective gapless boundary excitations, right, presumably, but not single particle ones to which G is sensitive. And so the matching of this then presumably implies that there are zeros of the Green's functions at the boundary. Okay, and so once this is understood, my approach to this is the following. So I think that it's okay to use this kind of topological invariance to try to identify different topological phases. But you have to remember that just knowing that this invariant is not zero, it takes some specific value, and it's only maybe a hint at what that system is doing, or one of many data points which we can acquire. But it's not a unique, nice way of telling us exactly what happens at the boundary. Because maybe there are gapless edge states at the boundary, or maybe there are some zeros. Maybe there are gapless edge states, but they are in a particle hole sector or in a not a single particle sector, but many particle sector of my system, and that will not know about this at all, because it's just a single particle Green's functions. And just let me quickly give you one example, which we went through, and I think that is the example where we completely understand the structure of the zeros and what happens to the topological invariant. And because I know that I ran out of time, I'll just say it in words, in just in a descriptive way. So as an example, we studied certain one-dimensional topological systems. Now, one-dimensional topological systems are very well understood, including in the presence of interactions. We have what we think is fairly good theory, which tells us everything which can happen to one-dimensional topological systems. In particular, there's an example of one-dimensional non-interacting topological system characterized by an invariant of the integer type, similar to this one, but different because it's odd number of dimensions, so it's a different expression. So for different integers, you get different phases. And all of these one-dimensional systems have zero energy localized states at the boundary. So in two-dimensional systems have chiral modes moving along the boundary, which have zero energy if k is zero. Otherwise, they're either above or below zero. But these one-dimensional systems have literally zero energy states at the boundary. So in the bulk, everything is gap, but at the boundary, there are zero energy states. And the number of such states is controlled by some topological invariant, the bulk invariant. You increase this invariant by one, you go through a phase transition, increase number of edge states by one. And so these kind of systems were studied already in the 70s, also in field theory literature. And now, more recently, people looked into what happens to the systems if you add interactions. And so a particular example of one-dimensional time reversal invariant interacting fermionic systems showed that if the original invariant was of the type Z, the new invariant becomes of the type Z8. So there are eight different phases. And but somehow, well, the Z classification, as we say, collapse onto Z8 classification. And the arguments for that originally was made by Fitkovsky and Kitaev, and then improved by many other people and given in a more precise form. And so one question which comes up then is, well, for these kind of interacting systems, I can still compute an invariant out of a single particle Green's function. It'll be some expression, not exactly this one because it's a one-dimension, but a similar expression. And I could compute it, and I could get any integer values. But they teach me that only eight of these values label different phases. The rest of them label the same phases as the ones, as the first eight. And so the question was, how does this happen? And so one question which was studied, and we studied this, by the way, numerically, just to make sure that we understand everything, plus some stuff could also be studied analytically. So one of the questions was the following. Suppose I'm in a phase where this invariant is equal to 8, but this phase is known to be trivial. Let me take my words back. So what I mean by this is the following. Let's take a first non-interacting state whose invariant is 8. And so that state has 8 gapless zero modes at the boundary. But let's switch on interactions. So it's known from this work, which I quoted, that once you switch on interactions, it's possible to gap out all the states at the boundary. If the invariant is anything from 1 to 7, it's impossible. But this invariant being 8 is the same as this invariant being 0. So then you can gap them out. And there's actually examples known, specific models, where you can gap out these states. But we have this bulk boundary correspondence. We have a bulk invariant. And we have a boundary invariant, which somehow counts these edge states. And the question was, what happens to this correspondence? And it turns out nothing happens to this correspondence. The bulk invariant remains to be 8 if it's expressed in terms of single particle Green's functions, even in the presence of interactions. But the boundary invariant no longer counts states at the boundary. It counts zeros at the boundary. And there's precisely 8 zero-value eigenstates of this kind of Green's functions, except its one-dimensional counterpart. You can actually verify this by direct calculation. Look at this Green's function, and it has exactly 8 such states. Now, and so that explains the reason why, with the invariant being 8 in these systems, somehow doesn't mean anything. You know, this state is in some sense trivial, because it doesn't have any edge states. Well, okay, not having edge states is not a good enough reason for it to be trivial, but in this case, we do know that it's a trivial state, can be converted into a state with the invariant being 0 without ever closing the gap. But so this is what happens to the boundary state. They get replaced by these zeros. One question which I always get in these cases is, I'm asked, well, you know, but can you use this to prove that the only way to generate zeros is to have those zeros in multiple of 8? If the invariant is not 8, you always have states at the boundary. But if it's multiple of 8, you can have just zeros at the boundary and no poles. And I don't know how to prove this. So all I know is that I, on example, I compute this and I see there are 8 zeros. But if I take an example where the invariant is 6, well, I know people told me that I will never be able to see 6 zeros. I may be able to see some zeros, but there'll also be poles at the boundary, because that's the way how people understand this, but from other reasons, not from comparing the invariants. Nevertheless, if I compute this invariant numerically, for example, and I discover it's not a multiple of 8, I will know that I'm in a trivial topological state. No. But if it is a multiple of 8, then I know that I'm in a trivial state, but the invariant itself doesn't tell me. Now, in a second type of question I could ask, suppose I take my system whose invariant is 0, I turn on interactions, and I deform it into a system whose invariant is 8. So at some point, the invariant will jump from 0 to 8. But people tell me it's possible to do this if I have interactions without ever closing the gap. So what happens to the invariant, and why does it change from 0 to 8? Well, this can also be checked. And what really happens is that as you change your parameters, at some point, you reach a special point. Now in the bulk, so you change your parameters everywhere, and you try to change your system so that invariant jumps by 8. So you reach a special point where the gap did not close. Nothing special happens from the point of view of excitations or from the point of view of the spectrum. But the Green's function has 0 eigenvalue, and the invariant jumps from 0 to 8 when that happens. But from the point of view of which phase you are in, you are still in the same phase. So the Green's function, in some sense, has more information than you need to know if you want to understand which phase you are in. Since it wants this invariant to jump, and it provides for this jump with zeros. Okay, but that's pretty much all I wanted to say. So I talked for much longer than I wanted to, but you can see that there was some message which I wanted to convey. And so the message is, it's okay to work with these invariants and calculate single particle Green's function and characterize them by these invariants. But you have to be very careful with the interpretation of what you see. And this bulk boundary correspondence was very useful, at least in one dimension, for our interaction work. And hopefully for potential future work in high number of dimensions to understand this kind of invariance for interacting systems. Okay, how about I stop here? I'll wait a couple
questions?
Yes.
So in principle, I understand that your topological insulator may have a gapful boundary because of zero Green's function instead of the poles. But I missed in catching that. What is a concrete example which shows that even in 1+1D?
Okay. Well, then I would have to. That's because I didn't give you this example. But I can write it down. Well, okay, how about I'll try to say it in words. So there's a well-known example, Fitkovsky-Kitaev model. So it's a model which, in the absence of interaction, reduces to a particle, several species of fermions hopping on a one-dimensional lattice, whose hopping amplitudes are dimerized. In other words, they alternate between larger and smaller values. And so a problem of one-dimensional fermion hopping on the lattice with hopping matrix elements alternating between larger and smaller ones, I mean, this was known to be topological for a very long time in the absence of interactions. And so what Fitkovsky and Kitaev demonstrated is that if you take exactly 8 species of Majorana fermions hopping on this kind of lattice, it's possible to cook up interactions, and not very hard to understand how you cook up these interactions, in such a way that you can turn on these interactions, and then you can actually make all hoppings equal, which in the absence of interactions would have closed the gap. But in the presence of interactions, the gap remains. And furthermore, you can change the order or change which hopping is larger and which hopping is smaller, which in the absence of interactions would induce a phase transition into a distinct topological state. But in the presence of interactions, there is no phase transition because the gap is maintained at all times. But you need to have 8 species of Majorana fermions for that to happen. And that's why this invariant jumps by 8. And it's exactly in this case that these topological invariants, in terms of Green's functions, exhibit the zeros at the boundary and also at the point where the invariant jumps in the bulk.
You say Z or Z2? Where does Z2?
So I have not discussed Z2 at all.
Okay.
So there are separate non-interacting topological systems with Z2 invariant, which you can also express in terms of single particle Green's functions. But so for Z2, it's less clear how to construct this bulk boundary correspondence. And I like to rely on it to give meaning to what this invariant means in the presence of interactions. We have some proposal, but it's not very useful for numerics. I mean, it's abstract. But in that abstract sense, there is a bulk boundary correspondence.
Related to a pi something or something?
Yeah, it is related to pi of something. It's just that pi is Z2 instead of Z.
The table that Cenci showed is related to that.
So he, in his talk, he started with non-interacting topological oscillators. He gave two examples, which, as far as I remember, all had Z's.
So the table I showed actually there's no interaction. So and actually even only interaction those states will not be reduced. Even only interaction classification should not change in those systems.
Yes, but now I remember you did have, because you showed everything as in how it depends on the dimensionality of space. So he had both Z's and Z2's, depending on what kind of systems he looked at. I mean, he was looking at symmetry-protected topological states. So then you can write several different invariants depending on which symmetries you have. Generally, without interactions, to write Z2, you need to have some kind of symmetries. Well, Z is possible even without symmetries, like in this example. But Cenci also considered what happens when you turn on interactions. And this Z collapsing into Z8 in one dimension, so step reversal, is one particular example. And I think he gave more examples, including in higher dimensional space, of Z collapsing into some smaller classification in the presence of interactions. By the way, how these invariants work out in case of this high dimensional collapse, I don't think it hasn't really been understood completely. So in one dimension, I think we have a pretty good control of what the invariants do as Z collapses into smaller groups. But in high number of dimensions, I don't think people studied this yet.
Yeah. So you talk about this ZA state, and you say when n equals 8, you calculate the boundary Green's function, you find 8 zeros.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering, for n equals 4, did you do the same calculation?
Yes, and then you have poles.
Four poles?
Okay, so one thing which I haven't verified is what is the maximum number of poles you can get rid of. So you'll have some poles. Some of the poles can be replaced by zeros, but not all of them.
So you find...
And so I haven't verified.
Zero,
okay, I should actually... It's even more subtle than what I just said. The right case is, even when n is equal to 4, when it's possible to get rid entirely of all the poles also and replace them by zeros in the presence of interactions. However, if you do that, there will always be gapless states in a non-single particle channel, in the particle hole channel. So it's possible to cook up Hubbard, large Hubbard U, which basically gaps out everything in single particle. And in the presence of interaction, that poles don't contribute to this anymore.
So you do see,
but if unless n is 8, there is always some states left
sure.
in higher channel, not necessarily in a single particle
it's
channel.
So 4-0 with gapless bosonic mode?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
In all the cases where a fermion system collapses into a boson, SPD, the single particle function, I'll be able to tell you anything.
Yeah, sure.
Well, okay, it can't, but if you calculate this, it'll still be 4. If you calculate this on the bulk. So you say it cannot tell me anything. Well,
single particle is totally gapped, right? In the whole system, it's totally gapped.
Right, but at the boundary, we'll have the zeros, however. And in the bulk, it will have non-zero topological invariant, at least in one dimension. So one dimension is the case where I think this is understood. So it does have some knowledge that the system is topological, but not through its states, but it's through its poles. So that was a very good question, actually, because it brought up this issue, which I also wanted to mention but forgot.
Can you ask for the boundary in time? Suppose I imagine going from one topological phase to another one at time
uh-huh.
equals zero. Does that boundary correspondence work in some way in time? Can you?
Well, okay. So if you do it very, very slowly, and so you, or do you mean, suppose it happens in time and there is something in the time slice, right? I think yes, but I'm not sure how that works. Actually, I was just looking at Cenci's paper, but who studied similar issues, I think. Whether there is an analog of this kind of expression, I'm not sure. You can actually formally write an analog of this expression in time, but I'm not sure if that works. It's just not completely understood.
Okay. So let's thank Victor. Okay,
So, I'd like to thank the organizers, although only George is here. Actually, last weekend, Ian came to me, to my office, and after some chatting, he asked me to talk about zeros and poles of single particle wave function in strongly correlated electron systems, particularly around the Mott insulator with all Mott insulators, including strong coupling superconductivity. So in that sense, my talk has nothing to do with topological aspects of zeros and poles. My mission is to talk about the present status, or the state of the art of the present progress about understanding about the zeros and poles in Mott physics. And on Mott physics, actually I'm very much indebted to many discussions in KITP for a long time. And actually in 1994, I gave a colloquia of KITP in the main seminar room on Mott transitions. And then Richard Martin or John Wilkins proposed to have this sort of discussion meeting, informal discussion meeting. But at that time, this auditorium didn't exist. And we had a discussion in the founder's room, only 10 to 20 people were there. So Richard Martin, John Wilkins, Walter Kong, and Doug Scalpin, and others were joining about that. The issue was what is the genuine Mott insulator. And after that, John Wilkins came to me, and he suggested me to write some review article on the Mott transitions. So that was the initiation of my writing some small review article in Reviews of Modern Physics.
So the achievement at that point was already even here. So I have to confess that I have to apologize that I didn't explicitly mention acknowledging KITP in the acknowledgement of that review paper. So I really apologize at that point.
Also, it's not such a small offer. Yeah.
So, after that, on Mod Physics, there are many, diverging progress made in various directions. So, one of the major progress is the understanding of excitation spectrum. In Mod insulator and dope Mod insulators, particularly structure of cells and poles of single particle Green's function. So, if you have just a Fermi level and band dispersion, just the no interacting band dispersion, the onset of a gap in the molten insulating state phase transition is signaled by the opening of the gap just at the Fermi level. At the beginning, it might be very small. And that is the structure of the molten insulator where the Green function has a upper Hubbell band and the lower Hubbell band structure as a pole. The Green's function is given like this, and we have self-energy. Now, if omega is largely positive, we have a positive real part of the Green's function in the largely omega region. And of course, we have a minus sign for the largely negative regions. And if you have poles, that makes a change in sign of the real part of the Green function. And you will have trouble if you only have poles of upper Hubbell and lower Hubbell band, how to assign the sign of the real part of the Green function here. And the solution is we have zeros of Green function, because if you cross zeros, then you can also change the sign of Green function. And this is indeed the structure which you can see in the cluster extension of the dynamical mean field theory. Here we have the upper Hubbell band, which is given in white area, and we have zeros, which bridges upper Hubbell band and lower Hubbell band. And if you see the spectral function, you don't see anything in the gap region, but in reality, you have zeros. So these are physics. It is not the, I'm not the first in mentioning this viewpoint, and Jaloszynski and Zwelik and the Morris guys and young model are well known, and indeed Stanisk and Kotolia studied by using cellular DNFT, and they reproduced, they found the structure basically.
So that was the zero at finite frequency, right?
So this is the real frequency,
yeah.
And you can draw anywhere at Fermi level.
Yeah.
Oh.
And in the molten insulator, the Fermi level is inside the gap region. And this is our calculated result of zeros and poles. It's rather complicated, but the basic structure is that we have Mott gap here. And very prominent zero surface is running. What happens if you dope the system? This is a case of a Hubbard model. So dope Hubbard model shows some part of the spectral weight collapses from the upper Hubbard band to the lower Hubbard band. But still, the global structure of the zero surface remains. Now, if you zoom up this top of the lower Hubbard band, then you see another formation of a zero surface, which separates to a pole surface. And this is the origin of the pseudo gap in this Hubbard model. So the energy scale is tiny as compared to the original Mott gap. Now, this zero surface pushes down the top of the lower Habermas, and that makes bending of the pole surfaces, and then it makes a sort of island structure above the Fermi level, indicated by bright green area. And that makes the pocket of the Fermi surface here. However, as I mentioned, this is formed by the pushing down of the zero surface. So zero surface is very close by in the outer part of the pocket. And the point of the divergence or zeros of the Green function means the divergence of the self-energy. That means complete breakdown of the perturbation theory is happening in that zero surface. And because of that, the damping is very strong around that zero surface. That makes that this part, outer part of the Fermi pocket, invisible in the spectral function, practically in experiments like angle-resolved photo emission. So we only have this pole fraction of the pocket that is known as a Fermi arc. If you see the momentum dependence, then with the energy surface, then you see an opening of the full gap structure, which is predominantly staying in the positive energy side. So you see the pocket surface is taking place here. Now, starting from the conventional Fermi leakage, which is in the heavily doped Hubbard model.
So, yeah. I have a question. So, technically, the zero surface is determined by looking at the self energy.
Right.
Divergence
yeah.
of real
yeah.
frequency
yeah.
self energy.
Yeah. Or zeros of Green's function.
Oh, yeah.
Equivalent.
But this is generated from the analytical continuation, you know, like.
Yeah, in this case, so we have done that in the analytic continuation, but we can also do that in the finite temperature or zero temperature exact diagonalizations, and then that you see directly real frequency information.
And those zeros does not exist for if I do single second FT, because then the self energy has no.
Well, zero can exist, but it doesn't have any momentum dependence, so it's just right. Flat.
But it has to connect to the upper half of the band and the lower half of the band. So
yeah, actually, even in the atomic limit,
right.
In Hubbard 1, you have this. Lower upper Hermite band and lower Hermite right. band. And then if omega is zero, then you have zero surface, but it's completely flat.
But this requires this particle forcing theory, right? Once in general, you don't have.
But in principle, you can add any kind of potential.
Okay, so you just shift the frequency.
Yes.
Yeah, just a brief question, just to make sure that the Green's function you're talking about, to relate to what Victor was talking about, is because the Green's function is still a matrix in orbital space, right?
But this is single band Hubbard model. So we
well, you because of the interactions you create two bands, right, up and a lower band.
Yeah, in that sense, we have a k dependence in the dispersion, so omega minus epsilon k. This is a Green function. So it's diagonal. So the momentum is a good quantum number. So we have a no diagonal. In non-interacting system at least. Okay. So starting from the conventional Fermi leakage, if you decrease the doping concentration, the system undergoes several Lifshitz transitions as well as pair creation of zeros and poles, and eventually you reach
the pocket-like structure which I mentioned, and eventually it disappears and it goes to the more insulating stage. So we have several phase transitions that makes this system disconnected with the conventional family. Now, these are the understanding in the normal state. What happens in a superconducting state? In a superconducting state, we can realize in TJ model or the Hubbard model when it is doped. And the first finding was brought by Meyer, Poelblom, and Scalacchino. They have calculated. Now, in the case of a superconducting state, we have in addition to the normal self-energy, we have anomalous part of the self-energy. And they have calculated this anomalous part of the self-energy. And they found a very prominent peak in the imaginary part of the anomalous self-energy just outside of the gap here. And that can be also reproduced in the Hubbard type model, where the anomalous self-energy again have a very prominent peak outside of the gap. The origin of this peak of imaginary part of the sigma anomalous was discussed in terms of spin fluctuation or the coupling to some bosonic mode. But there is no clear experimental indication that this type of structure exists in a real experiment like the RPS or STM and others. Now, the anomalous part of the self-energy is more or less proportional to the gap function. And the gap function at zero frequency is the real superconducting gap. So if you know the imaginary part of the gap function, you can get the real part of the gap function by Kramer's Kronig transformation. So this is the real superconducting gap at zero frequency. And the contribution to that real gap can be calculated just by integrating the imaginary part of delta in that way. And what we found is that the contribution of this prominent peak in the imaginary part gives you more than 80% of the gap at zero frequency. This means this prominent peak is indeed the origin of high-TC superconductivity in this Hubbard model. So the question is, what makes this peak? And actually, this peak in this cluster DMFC study is related to the formation of poles of anomalous part of self-energy or poles of the gap function. I have discussed the poles in the Green function, but here we see the formation of poles in the self-energy. And if we have a poles of the self-energy in the normal part, it shows the divergence of the self-energy. That means the zeros of Green function. This happens now in the anomalous self-energy. Now, let me remind you the structure of the anomalous and normal part of the self-energy, which appears in the single particle Green's function. So the basic Hamiltonian is given by the bare dispersion and normal self-energy contribution, as well as the anomalous part, which comes from the superconducting order. Now the Green's function, the normal Green's function, is given by the inverse of just this matrix, omega minus h inverse. So this can be inverted just by 2 by 2 matrix inversion. And what you obtain is the normal Green's function has a contribution of normal self-energy as well as anomalous self-energy. And anomalous self-energy appears just as a W function here, where the sigma anomalous contribute as a square. Now, I have mentioned that the anomalous part of the self-energy has a very prominent peak
That is the real origin of the high-TC superconductivity. If you see the normal part of the self-energy, it also has a very prominent peak structure. And surprisingly, the peak position has a perfect agreement if you plot the normal peak position and the anomalous peak position. And indeed, this comes from the pole of normal and anomalous part of the self-energy. And they have the same pole position. More surprisingly, when you calculate the single particle Green's function, as I mentioned, the contribution is coming from normal part and anomalous part, but only by the form of sigma normal plus W. And W has this structure. When you calculate this spectral function, AK omega, what you see is the sigma normal in W has a very prominent peak in this yellow region, but they exactly cancel as a sum. That means we don't have any singular behavior, prominent structure in AK omega. And this is the reason why it is overlooked in experiments, because it's missing. I mean, it's hidden in the spectral function. And because of that, in RPS or STM, in any kind of experimental probes, we don't see any signature of the origin of the high-TC superconductivity. Now, what type of model can realize that kind of exact cancellation of the, yes?
Before you go on to this part, so what do you think would be a good experiment to probe these poles of the normal and anomalous self?
Yeah, so it is a sort of a hidden excitation, and but the gap itself is coming from just the anomalous part of the self energy. So we need to specify possible experiments. One is to extract sigma normalous or sigma normal separately. And one possible way is to do the experiments without magnetic field or under the magnetic field. Then the sigma anomalous disappears when you apply strong magnetic field. And if we can assume that the sigma normal doesn't change, then we can extract only the sigma normal under a magnetic field, for instance. That is one possible ways. But if the magnetic field is too strong, the electronic structure itself is modified. So you need to do experiments very close to TC, probably. And even close to TC, you see the exact cancellations, but if you apply magnetic field, this can be killed. That is one possible experiment. And also, this is a single particle information. If you see the two particle response, like optical conductivity or Raman and so on, you can, well, in principle, it might be possible to see indirect evidence of the existence of this hidden structure. So let me briefly explain what type of model can realize this exact cancellation of pole and zero, of normal and anomalous part of self energy. Suppose we have a quasi particle barely present, and it hybridizes with some hidden fermionic excitations. And then these two fermions have both anomalous part. So we need to solve 4x4 matrix because we have two component fermions and both have number representations. And then we can calculate the Green's function for C operators. And then to make the story short, what we obtain is that by using this simple model, we can mathematically show that the sigma normal And the W part has the same position of poles in two omega positive and omega negative side, and they exactly cancel. That means the residue of poles of these two quantities are exactly the same with opposite sign. And W function has in total five poles, so two are canceled with this, and the three poles are left. And that three poles give you the experimentally well-known peak-dip hump-like structure in experiment that is in complete agreement with the experimental indication. And indeed, this very simple model can reproduce the cluster extension of the DMFT very nicely. So let me summarize. Zeros of Green's function generate first the mod gap, but also pseudo gap. And this is in very good agreement in the normal state with the numerics and experiments. If you go below TC, if you evolve the superconducting gap, then that zeros in the normal state of the surface energy continuously evolve. So it's basically the continuous. However, below TC, anomalous self-energy appears, and suddenly below TC, this anomalous self-energy cancels, the W function cancels the normal contribution of the self-energy in the pole position. So that is the reason why AK omega is invisible, but still the contribution of poles of the sigma anomalous is the origin of the high TC superconductivity. And to understand this rather puzzling features, as far as I know, the only the framework which can explain this physics is some kind of two-component Fermion model. One is quasi-particle, and the other is a Higgins one. So these are the present understanding of the zeros and poles of mod physics, and I hope it stimulates discussions for the complete understanding of the zero and the pole structure in topological insulators, because without understanding this trivial, well, mod insulator is in some sense trivial insulator, and based on this understanding, we need to go to the topological insulator with the strong correlation effects. So thank you very much.
Yeah, so in the pseudo gap or in the normal state that you calculated, actually do the zeros and the poles, they form a closed surface, or can you connect them to, you know?
Yeah. One side of a, so basically there is a pocket, but one side of a pocket is very, is close to zero surface. So this part is somehow contaminated by damping, and you have only arc-like structure, which is visible.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you take all the zero and poles together, you know, into account, do you actually match the Rottinger theorem, or because the Rottinger theorem says that
Rottinger theorem tells us that if you count zeros and poles together, then the Rottinger surface, the Rottinger theory must be satisfied.
Yeah,
but that is only justified without any phase transitions. But as I mentioned here, if you decrease, if you start from the conventional family kit, yeah, you must undergo some Lifshitz transition. And that makes the argument or proof of the Luttinger theorem rather question.
So that transition tuned by what parameter?
That's a doping.
Just doping. Well, then, why the
Rottinger
theorem?
Well, or you can control by U.
Control by U, yeah.
Interaction.
Well, but I thought Rottinger theorem should be very general. Shouldn't really.
Well, Rottinger theorem is general because it is connected to the non-interacting phase surface, but it is justified only when you don't have phase transition.
From
the non-interacting.
There is one issue. So
people can put different meaning in the word Lattice theorem, but a particular version of Lattice theorem, which connects number of particles to surfaces bounded by zeros of Clausius the Gries function, this relies on the existence of Lattice functional. And people, this relies on the existence of something called Lattice functional to prove that you can, okay, these surfaces of zeros and poles tell you something of the number of particles. And people made arguments that actually in modern solidity, in other perhaps phases, there's no Lattice functional. Because its existence was only was proven only perturbatively. And then we cannot rely on these zeros of Gries function as a way of telling you what happens to Lattice theorem in complicated phases. But definitely, people made these claims. People not believe in the claims only.
Short question. So, how many sites in the cluster?
That's a good point. So, in the superconducting state, we have done only for the 2x2 clusters. And but in a normal state, we can do a much larger system size, up to 16. And actually, I have how the system size dependence look like in the normal states, and we have done by this configuration of 7.4 to 16 sites, and the real part of the self energy or imaginary part of the self energy seem to show, well, you can say this is still size dependent, but more or less similar.
Okay. I just want to make one more remark. So Volodik made some very general argument that in the MOD insulator, single particle Gries functions must have zeros. Also a topological argument. I don't want to tell it, but I'm happy to discuss it later if anyone is interested. So anytime you have a MOD phase, you expect to have zeros, just because of that argument.
Well, I made some very intuitive argument about the sign of Gries function.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it was based on construction of yet another topological invariant, which was both Fermi surfaces and a MOD insulator, but which must not disappear when you go through a transition to a MOD insulator, and so you must generate the zeros to account for this topological invariant being non-zero when you're in the gap MOD phase.
But now the MOD insulator has been defined in the rudderless definition. So that's odd number of electrons per unit cell, right? Mm-hmm. So the definition is that zero.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the speed of grid phase.
Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah.
What's the MOD insulator?
You know, we have to assume spin.
Yeah.
Well, okay. In his definition, it's something which is connected by a phase transition to a Fermi liquid without changing the size of unit cell and without superconductivity.
Yeah, without any transition.
Without symmetry breaking.
Yes.
So you're saying that if the spin forms an order, actually
that's
wrong, or?
Yeah, if you form some Lagrange order, so then all of those zeros,
Well, even in anti-thermodynamic state, we have zeros surface.
Yeah, but that would be can be easily understood by.
Because if you make a Bogoliubov transformation
formation.
Then in that quasi particle,
These
are just two-band systems.
So
it's
nothing special, just you change the single particle part, step, like that. Okay, so let's thank Professor Bada again. I want to give a quick introduction about the quantum mechanical data on the WAP link.
I know this means discussions and I think things having spontaneously usually is more interesting than is planned. So let's continue this discussion. And I'm going to tell you about interaction-driven robotic phase transitions. that we can study from quantum Monte Carlo simulations. And I'm Ziyang Meng from Institute of Physics, Chinese Academy of Sciences. So let me just briefly mention the players of this game. Actually, this is a randomness across the Pacific Ocean. So in Beijing, except myself, we have these two great graduate students, Yuan Yaohe and Han Qing Wu, and Professor Zhong Yi Lu from Renmin University. And on this side of the Pacific Ocean, we have our great physics series of friends, Yi Zhong Yu and Chen Ge. So it's a combination of a theory and numeric work. So my talk is actually not so long, so I will start with some basic introduction of topological phase transitions, and I will then explain the model, the bilayer community of the model that we studied with our Monte Carlo simulations, and I will present the result that with spin of the carbon. If this looks like some time, I want to say something about the result without spin of the carbon, and this is actually making connection with our high energy trends that we find a place where, and the question is whether we will condense bilinear fermions in the mode transition or not. And the answer you will see, right? I mean, it's complicated, actually, from the simulation. So let's start from topological phase transition, and as Victor already introduced, the three fermions things are simple, right? I mean, we basically, to have a topological phase transition in the three fermions, most of the time, you require a single particle gap closes, right? For example, if I take an example, that is our familiar 10-milli model, so this is quantum spin Hall model that this system actually, if you plot the band structure of the bulk with finite spin of decoupling, that what you will see is in the bulk there's a gap produced by spin of decoupling. But you can drive this system through a topological phase transition by adding another hopping. This is a T3, and in this context, it's actually the third neighbor hopping, the honeycomb lattice, and this parameter will drive the system from a quantum spin Hall to a trivial band insulator. So this is the band structure, bulk band structure of quantum spin Hall. You have bulk gap, I mean, that's protected by Temer-Rosen symmetry. I mean, that's generated by Temer-Rosen symmetry, and that will protect the edge state. But as you gradually tune this tight band parameter, the T3, the third nearest neighbor hopping, you can drive a topological phase transition. What happens to the bulk band is that the gap which was here actually closes. Right? So this is the transition. This is a single particle picture. The gap closes, and this is the critical parameter you choose. And once the T3 is larger than 1/3 of T, you go to a band insulator. Band insulator also has a gap, but the difference is that this guy has no edge state. So that's we know very well, right? So the color coding doesn't really mean something. It's just I like colors, I probably mean this thing. So the important thing is the gap. Gap closed and opens. Right, so now if you calculate the topological invariant, and you can call it the topological invariant here, right? If you calculate the topological invariant, and this is actually precisely what Victor told us, it's a chain number, it's a spin chain number in this case. And actually I adopted a zero frequency version of the formula that Victor told us. So this is the momentum interval of the gradient zone, and inside this is actually your Baryk curvature, if you like. And this is written in a trace of the eigenstate of the single particle Green's function at zero frequency. Right? So you diagonalize the single particle Green's functions at zero frequency, you get these eigenvectors, and you use these eigenvectors to construct these protector operators. And you put blacklists in, and what is inside here give the Baryk curvature. And what you have to do is to integrate out through the entire gradient zone. And if you do that for the previous slides models, I mean, you see the chain number. So this is the spin chain number for up spin, right? So you see when the T3 is smaller than one third, you do have a one here, right? And notice that here, this is already some flavor of finite size effect, even for the non-effective system, that you have, if you do the calculation, for a small lattice, like L is linear system size of the system, that is the number was not really quantized. I mean, this is smaller than one. But in any case, when you tune the T3, you have a jump. You have a drop here, right? But there's a sudden jump, and as you increase your system size, this jump becomes more and more ideal. That you do have a transition from spin chain number 0 to 1.
That's you know, with SD conservation, the CR equals to -2 is not a trivial state.
So this is with that's
not a trivial state. I thought we agreed on that.
In terms of chain number, this is what you get actually if you do the calculation.
That's one to minus two, right?
You're right. So I go from a state with one edge state, if you like, plus three, to a state with a three So the change is three. So, but in any case, this is a topology transition, and you can calculate the change of the chain numbers, if you like, through this formula. Right? It works well in that sense. That's what I want to say. It works well. How about three-time interactions? Because three-time interactions seems to become more complicated. For example, the simplest thing you can do is to keep the KMD model, but not add a hardware interaction onset U. Right? At onset U, you can drive the transition like just cramp up U. Right? So in this case, what you see is that the single part gap does not close anymore. So what happened here is that actually if you plot, this is the gap. This is actually the single part gap of the system, and actually this is the spin gap of the system. So if you follow how the single part gap evolve as far as U, you will see it just shows some very well, minus deep here, right?
So this is happening.
Yeah, we can only do a simulation of happening, actually. So if you just follow how the single particle evolve as you switch on U, there's nothing particular happening. It's just a deep here, right? But how do I know there's a transition? Because I know the transition is because below and above this U, like around 5 here, this side of system develops antiferromagnetic order. And as it develops antiferromagnetic order, the spin gap actually closes. This is the collective gap, and here it goes no more. Right? So this is a situation where you do have a topological transition in the sense that the interaction cues the topological bending structure, and the single part gap does not close. Right? And here, if you plug the formula, the Green's function formula, it does not work. You just use the Green's function. The chain number does not change. Right? Chain number does not change. So this is not a very good example because this insulator breaks the symmetry that protects the topological bending structure. So we need some better example that we have a more transition and in this insulator inside, the symmetry is still preserved. Right? That's actually lead to the bilayer model that I'm going to talk about. So we can do the same trick.
In the finite size system, you don't break symmetry.
Well, but this gap we calculate to thermodynamic limit. So the way we do simulation, we really do finite size simulation, but we try to ask whether we increase the system size and it's calculated. And what I'm showing you here, for example, these other gaps, I think from our data, this is the thermodynamic limit, right? We have to calculate.
But the wave function breaks in symmetry?
I mean, thermodynamic limit it does, right? I mean,
but wave function you use to calculate the chair number, does it break the...
In a finite system, sorry, in the finite it does not. Yeah,
therefore, the argument that there's a topological transition, but the chair number doesn't change because
needs some more explanation, but we do have cases where when the more transition like this happens in a finite system, right? And then the single bundle gap, it closes. We do have cases where single bundle gap does close, and in that case, the chain number does change in the second part of simulation. So I think there's some deeper reason. I mean, actually, the fact that this single bundle gap does not close has some effect on the population of the channel. But anyway, I can tell you the model after this. So the model here I prepared is a bilayer model. So that's the model we want to design that in the insulating side does not create a temporal symmetry. So this is just, as the name said, just two layers of the KMD model, two layers of honeycomb lattice. In each layer, you have this nearest neighbor Hawking key, right? You have the imaginary nearest neighbor Hawking lambda, you have onset U, and to couple these two layers, we introduce an antiferromagnetic interaction between them. But there's no particle exchange, there's just a spin exchange between the two layers. And this model we can study with Monte Carlo simulation precisely. At half it still. And yeah, it's just some special way to write it, but the bottom line is this is the tight bending part with nearest neighbor Hawking and the scale of the coupling, and this is the Hubbard U term with onset repulsion, and this is the Heisenberg, if you like, J term, which is approximated, but it's in a half Hilbert limit is a very faithful approximation of Heisenberg. Right? So this is the system we prepare and we want to study it, right? And you already see actually just by looking at the model, you know there's some simple limit. For example, at large U, you still hope the system will form this antiferromagnetic phase, right? I mean the new order will still there when U is really large. But when the J is very large, right? When the interlayer coupling J become very large, you are expecting that you form this singlet between the layers, and you have a product state of this singlet. So this is a trivial insulator. But this insulator has not created a temporary symmetry that protects the topological construction.
So this is the bulk?
Yeah. This is the bulk.
This is the bulk.
Yeah, this is the bulk. Yeah, this is the bulk. So the corresponding to high energy crack physics is that when I switch this off, my tight bending part give me Dirac cones. And then I will ask what the interaction will do to my Dirac cones. Yeah, that comes later.
What are the anomalies? Are the anomalies leading to this?
Say again?
Are the anomalies?
No, in the bulk there's no anomaly. This is the
but at the boundary?
The boundary is the anomaly. Yeah. The boundary, when it's topological boundary, we'll definitely have an anomaly.
Yeah, so to solve it, like, yeah, this is a bit technical, but yeah. Anyway, so I think as the largest QCD friends do, we also do the Hubbard Schrödinger transformation to decouple the interaction. So the Hubbard term, which is parted here, is the decoupled to a quadratic form. The Heisenberg term, which is parted here, is also decoupled to the quadratic. I mean, just by doing this, we actually have a free fermion, that was a free system that we can really do the simulation. What we have to do is just to sample this auxiliary field leaves on each side, on each time, or on each bump, each time. Right? So that we do in a simulation, a very short description. So we can do this, and what we do in simulation is we do the measurement. So we can measure a lot of observables, for example, we measure the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, which is just energy itself. I mean, it has different parts, the tight bending part, Hubbard part, and the Heisenberg part. And we can also measure various correlation functions. In this case, I'm actually showing the spin-spin correlation functions. This is the spin-spin correlation. This is the structure factor, if you like, and divide the system size. We chop it to the thermodynamic limit to see whether this number is finite or not. If it is finite, you have a magnetic order. If it is zero, you have no magnetic order, right? And on top of this, we can have the single quantum Green's function. So this is the single quantum Green's function. We can calculate as function of momentum and the imaginary time. And from the imaginary decay of this quantity, we can extract the gap. So this is the single particle excitation gap. Right? And in the same way, if we do the dynamic spin-spin correlation functions, we can also extract the spin excitation gap by certain at each moment part actually, which we can capture, right? So then this is by no means an easy job. I mean, it's actually a highly simulations, and the simulation effort, if you know, scales linear in the inverse temperature and the cube to the system size.
You calculate the determinant.
Yes, this is decrams. This is decrams, yeah. Uh-huh. Yes. So we can gradually, I mean, so the system size here will be 4 times L squared, because we have 4 sets per unit cell, and L is the linear system size, we can gradually increase the system size and do the extrapolation. And of course, there's some, how small your data tau is, and so on and so forth, and that's the technical detail. But anyway, so this is decent simulation, we can do it, and let me show some results. So let me just go to the fixed diagram directly. So this is what we get after we do the simulations, and the fixed diagram is plotted in the axis of U and J. Right. So what do you, as we expected, so when there's in this corner, when there's no U and no J, you have a bilayer of the K-Mili model. So this is a topological band structure. So this is quantum speed of this vector, we just call it that way, right? So what happens if you gradually, let's say, increase U is that, as we expected, so at some point, this will be a transition above which the system established and defined in that Lorentz order, right? And as you go this axis, as you increase J, what happened is that there's a transition that separates this topological finite structure with a dimerized phase. A dimerized phase is an insulator, which is a product state of this singlet, right? So this is the topological phase transition. We will pay particular attention. And this has all been done with this fixed spin of the coupling stress. And if you tune the spin of the coupling stress a little bit, and what happened is just all the phase boundary has been shifted a little bit to the others, to the large interaction side, because basically in the non-interaction limit, this lambda is the energy zero that gives you the gap of the topological structure, and you have to overcome this gap, right? So by interaction, so that's why when you increase the lambda, the phase boundary shift to other interactions. So this is all what we get for the phase diagram. So then let me tell you, how do we actually get this phase diagram? You get this phase diagram by really scanning the parameters like this, you know, scanning the parameters and see what happens to the to the observables. And for example, the first thing we can do is that if we measure the spin-spin correlation functions on the interlayer bond. Right? If we measure the spin-spin correlation function between layer 1 and layer 2 on every side I, right, for a different value of U, right, for a different value of U as a function of J. So these are really these passes. Right? And if you see that, for example, at U equals 0, so this is this pass, and you see the correlation function. And when J is zero, when J is very small, this this product is very small because basically there's just two phase spins. But when the J value increase, this spin-spin correlation function becomes large, and actually it's approaching the limit of minus 3/4. When it reaches 3/4, this means that actually a singlet is forming the local picture. Right? If you have two spins, you form singlet, the product is minus 3/4. So in this way, you can see that actually. This is going through the from the topological from the spin insulator to the dimerized phase, and in fact, this object actually serves as the first derivative of the free energy. So that's the fact that this is continuous variable means this transition is continuous. So in this way, we actually can determine this is actually this blue pass. But you can take a derivative of other part of the Hamiltonian, for example, the Hubbard part. Basically, it's the double occupancy over J. So as a function of J, for even U, again, you'll see the peaks. You'll see even the peaks. Like, for example, this peak is actually this point. And this peak for U equals 2 is essentially this point. But the interesting thing is that, as you see, for those curves, when U is really large, for example, 5, even 4, that this curve has two peaks, right? This 1 and 2, this 1 and 2. This is nothing but these two transitions, one from the quantum spin Hall to the amplifier magnetic, and from amplifier magnetic to the dimerized phase. You can already see this boundary by doing this derivative of energy derivative of the energies. Right. And how about the gaps? How about the gaps, right? So let's say in this transition, what happens? About of the single particle gap. And the answer is the single particle gap here also does not close. So what it's showing here is a single particle gap at the K point, which is the corner of the collision zone, a different system size as a function of the J, right? A function of J. And what you see here is that actually there is some system size dependence, there's some dip here, but very quick. When system size is just 6, 9, or 12, it almost stops here. So that means this is almost a thermodynamic limit behavior. So across this transition, just like in a single layer case, there's no gap closed. No single particle gap closed, right? And again, what is closing is the spin gap. If you measure spin-spin correlation function at the gamma point, and to look at this for different system size, it's again through this pass, right? And you see there's a quick dip of it. And if you scale this, it actually looks like it's going close in a thermodynamic limit at somewhere here. So the critical, this is actually where the critical point is. So this transition has a spin gap closed. But the difference is that on this side, it's also gapped. This is a dimerized phase. It's different from the narrow state that there's no magnetic order. So this spin rotational symmetry is still preserved. Right. So this is a, in a sense, this is a pure topological phase transition done by interaction. So different from the single layer phase. And the next question is how about Chernobyl? We call it the spin Chernobyl with the formula that Victor gave us. And well, of course, we do everything on a finite system. So this is the finite size result. If you look at the 6 by 6 or 12 by 12, initially we thought, look, it's good that there's a small, you know, kink here. There's a kink here. So it seems like the spin chain number does change, you know, through this transition.
It's not integer?
Well, it's not integer because it's finite size simulation. Usually, you know, as I showed you, non-interacting case, you're expecting as you go larger and larger in the system size, you eventually, if that works, you have a 2 here and a 0 here. You get a sharp drop. So what we try, you know, we try to do larger system size, you know, we try to play some tricks. The trick we play is to do the interpolation, because we cannot do this large, 400 by 400, you know, it's crazy, it's just too large. So what we do is take our finite size data, take our, this is the 12 by 12 curve, what you saw in the previous slide. We interpolate between the real space point or momentum point, if you like. So, and when we do interpolation, we can determine, we can choose how many points we want to insert. And this is actually the system size we put into the, after interpolation. And after we do this, we can still calculate chain number. And now you see that this part, this side, actually goes up. Right. So in a thermodynamic limit, what happened is that it's 2 all the way. It's 2 all the way. So there's nothing changed.
But in the strong coupling limit, once J goes to infinity, so the state is just a single.
It's a product state.
Yeah, it's a product state. So yes. Use that. You can actually, can you calculate this chain number by using this product state? Because we have exact real wave function.
Yeah, yeah. So
yeah, that's precisely what we did in the previous paper. We showed that in that limit, although the ground state is a product state, the chain number, the number is still quantized as 2.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We can prove that. We can
leak through
that. Analytically, when we can prove there must be 2.
Okay,
that's so, interesting. Yeah. So if you go to the extreme J infinity limit, say like product state,
come on, little bit p.
Okay, so it's always little bit p, which makes it.
Then it will be.
Yeah, but two. In that case, there will be no k dependence, right?
Well, that's why turn a little bit
p. We need to turn a moment.
You can prove that in all order of our perturbation theory, it will always give you 2. Mm-hmm. So mean this number has nothing to do with the entanglement. Mm-hmm. This number has absolutely nothing to do with entanglement. Mm-hmm. It's just a mathematical artifact. It's nothing to do with a real physical. Mm-hmm.
So it does not mean the 2, I say, that the topological number will not change. It just means the way we calculate is not proper.
Well, essentially, in changing the integral to the sum is not correct.
Well, what I'm doing here is kind of, I mean, this is the sum, and I'm trying to go the other way, you know, increase the sum to mimic the integral.
Yeah.
But it does not work.
Yeah, actually, to check whether this number changed or not, you can just really take the critical point and calculate the Green's function and see if it has zero or pole. If it has no pole, then this number definitely cannot change at all.
What I know is, after the critical point here, I mean, for the block Green's function, there's nothing particular happened. I didn't see the either zero or pole. So the interacting system is, you cannot just use that formula, flatly. But we know this is a topological phase transition because, as we said, this is a product state, right? So what do we do? I mean, how do we really show that? We go for the edge state. We have to really look for the edge state to see whether on this side there's edge state or not, right? To do that, we have some tricks. I won't explain too much, but this is called a spin correlation. So actually, this is proposed by Chen Gu and Yi Zhuang, and we tested that with, I mean, analytically, and we test that with an all Monte Carlo simulation, it turns out it works very well. So what it does is that it's why it's strange, because usually in Monte Carlo simulations, we measure correlation functions. Right? Correlation functions means that it's expectation value of many-body ground state per side on both sides. Right? So it is strange here in the sense that we change the wave function, nature of wave function on one side. So this side, we prepare it purposely with a band insulator, a trivial band insulator. So in this way, it's strange. But it comes very natural to me, because if we prepare this side with a trivial band insulator, but this side, I mean the per side, is still the true many-body ground state wave function. So actually what happens here is that we on this side, we prepared, we started with some non-interacting determinant, if you like, and start time evolution. So start imaging time evolution. And these two wave functions actually meet, you know, at a particular time point. And because the system in a low energy limit has the Lorentz invariant, this time interface actually maps into a spatial interface. So if these two wave functions actually are topologically distinct, right, there must be edge state. And that edge state will be picked up by this correlation function. That's the construction, very simple. So I won't go into too much detail, and actually Yigong, I guess, will talk about this in his talk in the next month. So basically, what I'm doing is that I prepare this site, you know, with a trivial band insulator. And I prepare this site from my Monte Carlo simulations. So it depends now on the parameter of U and J, and that this whole thing will be either trivial, I mean either topological trivial or topological non-trivial. Right? For example, if I go along this way, if J is not so large, that this whole psi here is quantum spin Hall, so this is topological non-trivial, but when my J is large enough on this side, this psi becomes a mod insulator. Right? So I'm actually wiring this side, right? Wiring this side. And if there's a exit in the interface, this correlation function will show some divergence in some momentum point, and actually that is what we are looking for.
What about in thermodynamic limit, omega and psi can become orthogonal?
That's why you take the ratio.
The numerator and denominator both go to zero in thermodynamic limit. So what you do is that you first take finite size system, take the ratio, then you take the thermodynamic limit. You don't remain finite.
But they are different. Well, here I have a unit operator. There I have some operator.
Right?
Sorry? So the downstairs I can get zero without getting the zero upstairs.
Yeah. Yeah, they both approach zero in the same way, in the thermodynamic limit, exponentially.
So it looks like you have zero here, you have zero here, so the ratio is finite. But there's some particular key point that this thing is actually
singular,
finite, right? Then this thing becomes singular. We are looking for that singularity. Right. So this is very neat, because this is a bulk calculation. I don't really need to open the edge to look for the edge. I can look the bulk calculation and see the edge physics. So that is very neat. So yeah, let's just look at the data. So what I'm plotting is 1 over the single particle string correlator, right, for spin R. And as I said, so this data means I'm sitting at J equals 3, so I'm on this side, right? So this is momentum along the path, symmetrical path, and this is the 1 over the string correlation. So if there's a divergence of this quantity at this K point, right, the 1 over that is 0. Right? So what we are looking for is actually, if you plot this 1 over the string correlator, we were looking for if I'm on this side, if I'm on this side, I'm looking for some zeros. I mean, it's kind of like an edge state, if you like, signature.
What is green?
This is a finite-set effect, actually. So because of the construction of the limit we take. So yeah, so precisely at this point, this construction has some power. But what we are looking for is this behavior close to this high symmetry point. And as we increase the system size, 9, 12, 15, we are getting closer and closer to that particular point. So the point is that here.
So let me say one more thing. Yeah. So that green point, you can see that those these two plots, the green point has the same position. Actually, you can prove that for finite size system, that the number is always 2. So what you're looking for is sort of how it approaches that point. So it means that when the j is smaller than jc, that point is a singular, completely singular, disconnected from all the other plots. So we just look for how the curve goes to zero on the two sides.
So what is more important here is the function form. I mean how it's approaching the, in this case the end point of green and so on. So if the interaction is smaller than jc, you still have this kind of a vanished behavior. That means we still have cap is H mode in the boundary. But if the J is larger than JC, you know, the function form can completely change. Looks like here has been gapped. I mean, so there's no H state anymore. So we know, actually, on this side, there's no H state. So that's what we know. But the chain number does not work. The way of calculating the chain number does not work from the single value of this function.
So I guess, I will just skip this. I think let me just go to this, maybe just 2 minutes, go to the point where we switch off the sphere of the carbon. We start from the other points. And this is actually, again, the model, the same model. Now the tight bending part only has the nearest neighborhood, you have the other cones, right? So this is the precisely the model Tengel was talking about. So now, and let's try to see whether there is bilinear condensate, bilinear Fermi condensate or not, like in a phase diagram, right? So before we do this, show the data, we can actually understand, get some mean field understanding of this problem that we know that, for example, the four Fermi interaction U usually give you the antiferromagnetic phase. It's one way to get the fermions, but this is one of the bilinear condensate. So the J term, Heisenberg J term, can generate the bilinear condensate in two different ways. One way is to form an interlayer S wave singlet pattern. So this is how all the parameter looks like. So it's just between the layer one and the two on the same side, you form a singlet. Right? So if you have bilinear condensate, I mean, this thing is long range object. So the Heisenberg term can be written, this is some operator identity, actually, can be written as this operator, delta. But it also rearranges some condensate, which is nothing but the kinetic energy between layer one and layer two. So you sum the hopping from layer one to layer two of spin up and also spin down. So this is, in our language, this is in the particle-hole channel. This is in the particle-particle channel that you can condense. Right? So this Heisenberg term, J term, you just by looking at the Hamiltonian, it gives you these two ways of form the condensation. And the question is whether it does.
Yeah, so is there any SiO2 symmetry which can link these two?
In this case, I'm not sure. In some particular pass of the J and U.
A special ratio.
Yeah, it's sort of general.
There's a larger symmetry SO5 can link these other properties.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, if this J and U are all arbitrary.
Oh, you have U.
Yeah. So the phase diagram, this is the phase diagram. So the phase diagram is U and the J. Right. So this pass is actually what Tengel was talking about the other day, right? What they also did some simulation here. So what I have to say is that of course you have semi metal here, the dual cones and As you gradually, I mean, let's say that for the time being, just switch off U, just increase J. At some point, you actually trigger the system into another phase. This phase has excellent condensate. So this phase does have bilinear condensate. It's long range. And if you keep increasing the J, you again go to the dimerizer phase. Right? So in the same way that if you increase U, right, at some point, you will have antiferromagnetic phase. So now the question is, are there paths like this, that there's a direct transition from semi-metal to this dimerized phase? I don't know. What I know is what this path Tengel has chosen is unlikely. This point probably is masked by the excellent condensate.
We don't have a data point.
Yeah, I do. I didn't show it. I mean, I didn't show it yet. Yeah. So what we have to do is again scan the phase diagram. Yeah. So I mean, so how the phase merge this and this really in this area? I don't know. I don't know so far. I mean, we are still pushing the simulation. Okay. So yeah. Just last slide. Just to show the condensate. It's just to show an example how do you see the condensate. So let's take this pass. U equals zero, this pass. Let's just measure, so what we do is we measure correlation functions between different set I and J. And do the Fourier transformation and pick up the particular order of wave vector and see how this guy scale, you know, with system size. Right? So this is finite size dependence of this structure factor of the condensate. That actually, I mean, of course, I think in critical system size, it goes down, but the point is that when the system depth is large enough, they almost saturate. Right. So this is where this what is showing here is just precisely this window. Right. So this window right here, this bump right here, means that in this window we do have a long range of linear Fermi condensate. So this is the way we scan the phase diagram, and still I have to say somewhere here we are still working on it.
Yeah, just so let me one comment. Actually, In the land we choose, there's an SO5 symmetry, which I relates the exciton and the antiferromagnet.
Okay.
So
we have to
check both.
Yeah, we do check both. I mean, when I just show this, but
well, I mean, so it means that if that point has an exciton condensate, must also have an antiferromagnet.
Yeah. I mean, the real difficulty is that the finite size interpolation become harder here. Yeah, that's
I guess
you guys have similar problem. I mean, it's just so we have
to
just work hard.
Or somehow they can do much bigger system size, though.
So this region is that I put here is still questionable. I don't know. Yeah. That's what I'm showing here is honestly what I know so far. So I think with this I can stop.
Okay.
Can you see how the zero surface appears and evolves in the
I have to look at it. I didn't know.
But you can
talk. We have to do this function.
Yeah.
We can plot it.
Oh, it's curious.
That's
okay. So the design of this strange correlator is related to which type of many-body gap closes. So in your case, it's a spin gap closes. So you define your string correlator according to the spin.
You measure the string correlator. Yeah. It's a correlation function. You can measure any channel you like.
Right. So it's not necessary to be spin. But you can like
pairing.
Even the four particle.
Yeah. So if you have
six particle, multi-particle, all possible channels. But you cannot rule out all the
possible. Well, sure. Yeah, that's where we work on the most conventional cases.
So this exciton condensate is actually by itself an interesting phase people are looking for it in various systems. I think you could enlarge it by offsetting the chemical potential in one layer up and the other down so that you get particle hole nesting. I think that would still preserve the overall particle hole symmetry of your system.
We don't need the overall.
So you would not have a negative sign problem. And then
because it'll make the region more pronounced.
Once you have finite Fermi surface, then exciton instability occurs at infinitesimal coupling. It's like a BCS instability.
Okay.
So I'd expect this to enlarge the phase. And it might be interesting because people are looking for this in graphene, actually, in bilayer graphene. Experimentally, they haven't found it yet, but it's an active field of research.
I didn't know much about it actually. We just calculated and we found this, and then we go look for the literature and you said barrier from all the activities.
About with the spin with coupling case, the gap opening at the edge state can be written in the edge state low energy effective theory. Usual case, we can have some effective interaction between the edge state. And in your case, you have two pair of the edge
states
coupled with through J.
Yes.
So in this case, you can easily understand this gap opening at by using such a low energy effective model or not?
I think, in fact, each one is rotor.
Like on the edge, you have two pairs of counter-propagating fermion modes, and then under interaction, they become two bosonic modes, which are exactly the 2D bosonic SPT edge modes. And this direct transition can be described as a SPT transition, bosonic SPT transition.
Okay, if there's no further questions, thank you all for watching.